Cassette 1, Side 2. This was for me one of the first of many encounters with Farmer's use of the word comma placed at the end of a sentence. It stood for the word that would follow the comma, which was asshole. I understood he wasn't calling me one. He would never do that. He was almost invariably courteous. Comma was always directed at third parties, at those who felt comfortable with the current distribution of money and medicine in the world. And the implication, of course, was that you weren't one of those. Were you? In the mornings, I followed Farmer from the courtyard to email and then to his office on the ground floor of the newest building, the Thomas J. White Tuberculosis Center. Diplomas hung on the wall, together with a photograph of Haiti's first elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Farmer's friend of many years, posing with a boy whom Farmer had cured of TB. There was an examining table, an X-ray viewer, a desk, and a new office chair that the staff had bought him for Christmas. It still had some tinsel on it. Farmer sits down at his desk. Now the objective is? He looks at me. I shrug. He says, to stay put, because people are lurking outside. Lurkacious behavior. A crowd of perhaps 30, on occasion I counted 40, waits in the hall, some sitting on benches, some milling around. A nurse in white uniform enters, saying to Farmer indignantly, I always say patients must sit down and they don't listen to me. Farmer smiles at her, making the Haitian hand slap, the back of one hand into the palm of the other. It's a cross we must carry, he says. The nurse stalks out. He looks over at me. You can't sympathize with the staff too much, or you risk not sympathizing with the patients. They are indeed the poor and the maimed and the halt and the blind. An elderly man in treatment for pulmonary TB who makes me think of Ray Charles. He's blind but wears glasses. He had said he wanted glasses, so Farmer had found him a pair. A younger man whom Farmer refers to as Lazarus, who arrived some months ago on a bed frame carried by relatives, wasted by AIDS and TB to about 90 pounds, now weighing in at about 150, cured of TB, and his AIDS arrested thanks to medications. A healthy-looking young woman whose father only a month ago was saving up for her coffin. And on the other hand, a lovely-looking young woman being treated for drug-resistant TB, now in the midst of a sickle cell crisis and moaning in pain. Okay, Dudu. Okay, chérie, Farmer coos. He orders morphine. A man with gastritis, in late middle age. In Haiti, Farmer told me, that could mean 30 years old, since 25% of Haitians die before they reach 40. It's because there's a near famine here, says Farmer, examining him. The man is muscular. Perhaps in his declining years he can't scrap for food as well, or maybe there's someone he's trying to feed. He orders nutritional supplements. A 16-year-old boy, too weak to walk, who weighs only 60 pounds. Farmer diagnoses an ulcer. His body's gotten used to starvation. We're going to buff him up. Farmer hefts a can of the dietary supplement Ensure. This is good stuff. We'll give him 3 cans a day, so we'll give him a couple of $100 of Ensure, and I'll take great pleasure in violating the principle of cost efficacy. A very small, elderly-looking woman, her body bent at the waist, at a right angle. Long before Farmer met her, tuberculosis of the spine had devoured pieces of her backbone. A case of Pott's disease, easily cured, but it had gone untreated and was burnt out. There's nothing to be done for it now. She's come for money and food and company. Farmer stands when she enters, greeting her as Mami Mwen, my mother. He bends down, practically kneeling, and she kisses him on one cheek, then the other, and says, A son always cares for his mother. Farmer gets her a chair, and she holds on to it, still standing, resting her chin on the seat, and watches as he ministers to the next several patients. As at the Brigham, he seems bound to get as close to them as possible. He has them sit in a chair right next to his, so that, I figure, he can get his thin, white, long-fingered hands on them. He calls the older women mother, the older men father. Many bring him presents. Milk in a green bottle with a corncob stopper. Oh, chérie, mais y en pis, en pis. Thank you, Farmer says. He smiles, and staring at the bottle on his desk, says in English, unpasteurized cow's milk in a dirty bottle. I can't wait to drink it. He turns to me. It's so awful, you might as well be cheerful. I look up. A very pregnant woman is forcing her way past the nurse and in through his office door. She's infected with HIV and is here to receive isoniazid prophylaxis, having also been exposed to TB. She also needs money for food. Her husband has died. She lifts her voice high and cries cheerily, "You guys are all my husbands!" A young man enters next. "Dr. Paul, I came here and was sick. Now I'm much better. So I would like a picture taken." On the wall beside his desk, Farmer has taped up 3 sheets of yellow legal paper. On every line, a task to be completed. And beside each of those, a hand-drawn box. In Creole, a boîte. I've noticed that if he completes a chore that he forgot to put on the list, he writes down the chore, makes a boîte beside it, then puts a check in the box. This seems to give him an inordinate pleasure, and I must admit that I feel some myself, completely unjustified, when he says, "We're getting a lot done." The list on the wall contains about 60 imperatives to assemble the slides for upcoming speeches, to get Lazarus a Bible and a pair of nail clippers, to give another patient the wristwatch he bought for him in the Miami airport, to obtain sputum samples from some of the patients with drug-resistant TB and take them to Boston for testing. The list seems to speak of what, in Boston, might be called an interesting practice. Certainly, it is varied. One item reads, "Sorcery consult." In one of his books, Farmer had written that there was a distinction in the Haitian countryside between belief in sorcery and the theories and practices called voodoo. That is, not every peasant practiced the indigenous religion called voodoo, but virtually everyone, including Catholics and Protestants and voodooists, believed in the reality of magi, of sorcery. For many people around Cange, magic spells sent by enemies were the deep cause of many illnesses. And many people around Cange believed that Farmer, like all good voodoo priests, knew how to contend with magi. One local peasant told me, speaking of Farmer, "God gives everyone a gift, and his gift is healing." Once at a public ceremony, a former patient of his stood up and declared, "I believe he is a god." It was also said around Cange, usually in whispers, "Dr. Paul works with both hands," that is, both with science and with the magic necessary to remove ensorcelments. Most of the encomiums seemed to embarrass and amuse Farmer, but this last, he's explained, has a painful side. Haitians believe in sorcery because their culture has evolved in the absence of effective medicine. So of course they believe in sorcery, in sicknesses that someone has sent to them. Why else would someone fall into a coma? And when someone is very sick and people are used to seeing them die with the same symptoms, and you give them meds and they rapidly recover, people think, and then they start talking. In his experience, most Haitians eagerly embrace effective medicine. He has dozens of voodoo priests among his patients, some of them serving as virtual community health workers, bringing him ill parishioners. Sorcery is, at bottom, the Haitians' way of explaining suffering, but the allegations themselves can cause suffering. Now an elderly woman enters Farmer's office. She's the subject of the sorcery consult. The other day, in the courtyard, Farmer saw her son moping around and asked him what was wrong. "My mother hates me," he said. In fact, the mother believes her son sent the sickness that killed another son. As she sits down beside Farmer and he begins telling her, not that sorcery doesn't exist, but that he knows sorcery wasn't involved in this instance, she lifts her chin and averts her face. Gradually she softens, but it will probably take months to reconcile her fully with her surviving son. When she leaves, Farmer says he feels 86% amused, and I suppose this means 14% sad. The woman had insisted that her son had sold his brother, using the Creole word once applied to slaves. Haitian beliefs in sorcery were perhaps in part inspired by the slave master's own fears, born of guilt. A great many beliefs and practices in Haitian magic originate from Normandy, Berry, Picardy, or ancient Limousin, writes the anthropologist Alfred Métraux. Moreover, accusations like the woman's always seem to spring from the jealousies that great scarcity inspires. The accused son lives in a better tikai than his mother. In effect, she was saying this son didn't care about his mother, so he must have been the one who sent sorcery to kill his brother. These kinds of allegations, accusations that arise out of economic inequalities, are common, Farmer says. They can tear families and friends apart. When I realized that, I thought, oh man, it's not enough that Haitians get destroyed by everything else, but they also have an exquisite openness to being injured by words. After a few days in Cange with Farmer, I came to expect such interpretive discourses. Farmer called them narrating Haiti. I don't want to exaggerate this tendency of his. He was capable of maintaining companionable silences, indeed, often seemed to prefer them to talk, and he made light conversation at least as often as he proselytized. Besides, I was trying to get the hang of his cosmology, so I egged him on, sometimes even badgered him into narrating Haiti. When he got going, though, everything around us became the occasion for drawing a moral about the suffering of the Haitian poor, which often also served as a lesson about the suffering of the world's poor. Sometimes he'd pause to ask for a reaction. You feeling me? And for me, the problem often was that I couldn't muster a sufficient response internally. I'd feel sorry that so many Haitian children still died of measles, though not in Zanmi-La-Santé's catchment area, but I'd also feel that I could never be sorry enough to satisfy him. I'd end up annoyed at Farmer for a time, in the way one gets annoyed at others when one has done them a disservice. Days and nights ran together. Farmer liked to tell his Harvard students that to be a good clinician, you must never let a patient know that you have problems too, or that you're in a hurry. And the rewards are so great for just those simple things. Of course, this meant that some patients waited most of a day to see him, and that he rarely left his office before dark. Through the louvered windows high on the wall behind his desk, I see stars shivering in the warm night. A sad-faced young man takes his seat beside Farmer and stares down at his own feet, shod in ragged running shoes, splitting at the heels. His name is T. Ofa. He has AIDS. When he's on duty at the Brigham, Farmer runs the hospital's AIDS service, and he's handled T. Ofa's case, as he would have in Boston, treating various opportunistic infections with antibacterials until the infections become chronic. Zanmi-La-Santé doesn't have the wherewithal to measure viral loads and CD4 counts, but from long experience, Farmer knows the virus is about to begin its endgame with T. Ofa, its overwhelming stage. T. Ofa says, I feel ashamed. Anybody can catch this. I told you that already, Farmer says. He opens a drawer in his desk and takes out a large plastic bottle. It contains indinavir, one of the new protease inhibitors used for treating AIDS. No one else, not at this time, is treating impoverished Haitians with the new antiretroviral drugs. Indeed, almost no one in any poor country is treating poor people who have the disease. Even some of Farmer's friends in the Haitian medical establishment have told him he's crazy to take on AIDS this way in Cange, and certainly many experts in international health would agree. Leaving aside all other objections, the new AIDS drugs could cost Zanmi-La-Santé about $5,000 a year per patient. Nonetheless, Farmer had started some patients on triple therapy. A few months ago, he gave a speech to a group in Massachusetts called Cambridge Cares About AIDS. Cambridge cares about AIDS, he told them, but not nearly enough. He wondered if he'd gone too far, but afterward, at his suggestion, health workers in the audience and people who themselves had AIDS collected a bunch of unused drugs, and he ended up with enough to treat a few more of his patients here in Cange. He intends to increase those numbers, he says. He and his colleagues back in Massachusetts are working on grant proposals to obtain a larger, more reliable supply. They'll find the money, he's told me. Of course we'll find the money. He holds up the precious bottle for T. Ofa to see. He shakes it, and the pills rattle around inside. He tells T. Ofa that he'll start treating him with this drug and two others now. They won't eradicate HIV from his body, Farmer explains, but they will take away his symptoms and, if he's lucky, let him live for many years as if he'd never caught the virus. He only has to promise that he'll never miss a dose. Teofa says he won't, but he's still looking at his shoes. Farmer leans closer to him. I don't want you to be discouraged. Teofa looks up.
Just talking to you makes me feel better. Now I know I'll sleep tonight.
He wants to talk, and I suppose he knows he's welcome to do so.
My situation is so bad. I keep hurting my head because I live in such a crowded house. We only have one bed, and I let my children sleep on it, so I have to sleep under the bed, and I forget and I hit my head when I sit up. I don't forget what you did for me, Dr. Paul. When I was sick and no one would touch me, you used to sit on my bed with your hand on my head. They had to tie up the dogs in the village. You walked around so late to see sick people.
Teofa declares,
I would like to give you a chicken or a pig.
Ordinarily, Farmer's skin is pale, with a suggestion of freckles underneath. Now it reddens instantly from the base of his neck to his forehead.
You've already given me a lot. Stop it.
Teofa smiles.
I am going to sleep well tonight.
Okay, Negpa, my man, says Farmer. Then it's time for rounds. First by flashlight down the path to the hospital and through the dimly lit main ward, where the beds are filled by adults, and then, with trepidation, to the children's pavilion upstairs, where there always seems to be a baby with the stick-like limbs, the bloated belly, the reddish hair of Kwashiorkor, a form of starvation. Just a week or so ago, on his first morning back in Kanj, Farmer had lost a baby to meningitis in its ghastly purpura fulminans presentation, the small vessels bleeding into the baby's skin, making a rash of purple spots. And, only days later, another baby from beyond Zami La Santé's catchment area died of tetanus. Farmer lingers beside the crib of a little girl with wasted arms and a torso bloated by pleural effusion caused by extrapulmonary TB. She lies on her side. He reaches in and strokes her shoulder, saying softly, almost singing, in English,
Michelle wants to give up, but we're not going to let her, are we?
No, we're not going to let her. Then he walks back up the hill to the tea hospital. Save his visit for last, he says, because just now everyone up there getting better. Most of the patients have gathered in one room and are sitting on the beds watching a soccer game on a wavy, snowy TV screen.
Look at you bourgeois people watching TV, Farmer says.
The patients laugh. One of the young men looks up at him.
No, Dr. Paul, not bourgeois. If we were bourgeois, we would have an antenna.
It cheers me up, Farmer says on the way out. It's not all bad. We're failing on 71 levels, but not on one or two. Then it's back down the hill and out the gate and across Highway 3 to his house. Night in the mostly unelectrified central plateau is vast. Roosters are crowing. They crow here at all hours. And a warm wind rustles the leaves of the trees that surround Farmer's little patio, lit by battery power. It feels like the cabin of a small boat at sea, a cozy enclosure, where Farmer now sets to work on speeches and grant proposals, assisted by a young member of Partners in Health, a PIH-er in Farmer's vernacular, sent from Boston for this purpose. He holds a huge stack of medical studies on his lap. After a time, he puts them aside.
I'm not into this, guys.
He takes me on a survey of his grounds. It's clear that a proper guest has to accompany him. This is called hortatorture, he says. He recites the names of the trees, vines, shrubs, flowers that he's planted here over the years. I count about 40 different species. Finally, in the dim light from the patio, he studies a new fern that has just come up.
It's just vibrant and happy and healthy, the way a patient should be.
The word patient is like a bell. He goes back to work on the pile of clinical studies. Minutes later, Tijan, Zanmi La Santé's chief handyman, appears out of the dark, summoning him back across Highway 3. In a bed by the door of the hospital lies a moaning 13-year-old girl, just arrived by donkey ambulance. Two young Haitian doctors, one is just an intern, stand beside her bed, eyes half-lowered, lips pursed, as Farmer makes the Haitian hand-slap saying, Dr. Mio, ça cap passant. Doctors, doctors, what's going on with you? His voice sounds plaintive, not angry, as he lectures. You do not administer an antibiotic to a person with meningitis until you have done a spinal tap and know the variety of meningitis and thus which drug will work. Then he does the job himself. The young doctor's looking on, holding the girl down. I'm very good at spinal taps, he's told me. He seems to be, and besides, he's left-handed, and to my eyes, left-handers at work have always looked adroit. The veins stand out on Farmer's thin neck as he eases the needle in. Wild cries erupt from the child.
Lifemwal! Moingwangu!
Farmer looks up, and for a moment he's narrating Haiti again. She's crying, it hurts. I'm hungry. Can you believe it? Only in Haiti would a child cry out that she's hungry during a spinal tap. Chapter 4. Soon after I arrived to visit him in Kanj, Farmer said he'd be my Virgil here. I think that, when it came to Haiti, he viewed almost everyone as a potential subject for education or re-education. No other country in the world had been subjected to as much idiotic commentary, he said, and it would have been hard to argue the point, given the fact that, for instance, the name of Haiti's indigenous religion had long since become the synonym for crazy ideas and sheer luridness. Farmer liked to tell a story about his own education in Haiti, a story about the relation between medicine and beliefs in sorcery. Back in 1988, a woman from Zalmi-La-Santé's catchment area had died of tuberculosis while he was in Boston recovering from a badly broken leg. When he returned to Kanj, several of the staff told him the woman wouldn't have died if he'd been on hand. They meant this as a compliment. He converted it to self-reproach. He wanted a medical system that functioned in his absence. He gave everyone in the woman's family jobs at Zalmi-La-Santé and called a series of staff meetings to figure out what was wrong with their system for treating TB. The staff had a lively debate. Zalmi-La-Santé's community health workers, who lived among the peasant farmers, who had been until recently mostly peasant farmers themselves, spoke about the economic impediments to treatment, pointing out that the poorest patients tended to fare worst, certainly in part because of malnutrition. One health worker recited a Haitian saying, "Giving people medicine for TB and not giving them food is like washing your hands and drying them in the dirt." But most of the professionals on the staff, the Haitian doctors and nurses and technicians, offered explanations that laid the blame in the minds of the patients, the kinds of explanations one often reads in scholarly journals. Once they felt better, but long before they were cured, patients stopped taking their pills, the professionals said. And patients did this in part because they didn't believe TB came from microbes, but believed it was sent to them by enemies via sorcery. Farmer felt intellectually torn. The health worker's theory amounted to a description of the kind of socio-economic arrangement that he called structural violence. But he was also an anthropologist in training, schooled in the importance of the kinds of cultural beliefs that the professionals cited. So he designed a study. He was still a student at Harvard. The study was like a class he created and then attended as a pupil. He selected two groups of TB patients. During the study, each group got free treatment, the same they would have received at the Brigham. But one group got other services as well, including regular visits from community health workers and small monthly cash stipends for food and childcare and transportation to Kanj. Farmer hiked to the many villages of the patients, visiting all of them in their huts. This took weeks. 100 chatty Haitians, he would say. Don't try this at home. He asked all of them, among other questions, if they believed TB came from sorcery, and all but a very few in both groups said that they did. And yet, when the results came in, the cure rates for the two groups were dramatically different. Of the patients who had received only free medicine, a mere 48% were cured. By contrast, everyone in the group that received the cash stipends and other services made a full recovery. Whether a patient believed that TB came from germs or sorcery didn't seem to have made any difference at all. Farmer felt puzzled. I expected to buy into the idea that what's in people's minds affects their behavior and the outcomes, he told me. And he was at a loss for explanations, until he began re-interviewing the patients and called on one of his favorites, a sweet, rather elderly woman. When he had first interviewed her, about a year before, she'd taken mild offense at his questions about sorcery. She'd been one of the few to deny she believed in it.
Polo, chérie, she had said. I'm not stupid. I know tuberculosis comes from people coughing germs.
She'd taken all her medicines. She'd been cured. But now, a year later, when he asked her again about sorcery, she said that of course she believed in it.
I know who sent my sickness, and I'm going to get her back, she told him.
But if you believe that, he cried, why did you take your medicines? She looked at him. He remembered a small, sympathetic smile. The smile, he thought, of an elder explaining something to a child. In fact, he was only 29.
Chérie, she said, est-ce que pas qu'on comprend bague qui passant?
The Creole phrase, passant, means not simple, and implies that a thing is freighted with complexity, usually of a magical sort. So in free translation, she said to Farmer, Honey, are you incapable of complexity? And then, of course, it dawned on him that he knew plenty of Americans, he was one himself, who held apparently contradictory beliefs, such as faith in both medicine and prayer. He felt, he said, as though he hung in the air before his patient, suspended by her sympathy and bemusement. The study was for him a command, to worry more about his patient's material circumstances than about their beliefs. From then on, all TB patients in the catchment area received the full package of services. Each continued to get what is called directly observed therapy, a community health worker on hand to be sure the patient took the medicines on schedule, and each got the monthly cash stipend, the equivalent of about $5 American, to pay for extra food, child care, and transportation to a monthly doctor's appointment at Zomi La Santé. The program had worked well. Indeed, couldn't have worked better. They hadn't lost a single patient in 12 years, and Farmer wasn't about to change any of the rules. Just recently, a TB patient from a village called Mont-Michel hadn't shown up for his monthly doctor's appointment. So, this was one of the rules, someone had to go and find him. The annals of international health contain many stories of adequately financed projects that failed because non-compliant patients didn't take all their medicines. Farmer said, The only non-compliant people are physicians. If the patient doesn't get better, it's your own fault. Fix it. A favorite Dr. Paul story in the village of Cai-Epan was of the time many years back when Farmer had chased a man into a field of cane, calling to him plaintively to come out and let him treat him. He still went after patients occasionally. To inspire the staff, he said, and to give him a break from his office. So he was going to Mont-Michel himself, and was taking me with him. Beyond mountains, there are mountains. The proverb appeared to describe the location of Mont-Michel, the most distant of all the settlements in Zami La Santé's catchment area. At breakfast on the appointed day, Farmer told the women in the kitchen his intentions.
Ooh, they cried.
One said,
Mont-Michel. Polo, do you want to kill your blanc?
She meant me, of course. She wasn't being rude. The women in the kitchen called even Farmer a blanc. Usually, they called him petit blanc moins, meaning my little white guy. But a blanc isn't necessarily white-skinned. One might say every blanc becomes white by virtue of being a blanc. The African-American medical student Farmer had brought here some months back, for instance. Some people at Zomi La Santé had wondered if he was Farmer's brother, and later, some had mistaken another visiting black American student of Farmer's for the first one. And when Farmer teased them about this, one of the staff had said, Farmer swore this was true,
All you blancs look alike.
Farmer drove the first leg in the pickup truck, south down National Highway 3, past two-roomed huts with metal roofs and little granaries on stilts, built, he explained, to keep food safe from animals, but rats still ate about a third of harvests, and stunted-looking pigs and goats and scrawny yellow dogs. Smiling for a moment, he said that Haitian peasants had a lot of sayings, that they're the only farmers with land so steep they break their legs in the cornfields, that their dogs are so skinny they have to lean against trees in order to bark. Soon, a reservoir came into view, a mountain lake far below the road. The scene looked beautiful, blue waters set among steep, arid mountainsides. And if you saw with peasant eyes, Farmer said, the scene looked violent and ugly, a lake that had buried the good farmland and ravaged the highlands. He parked beside the ruin of a small cement factory. Plants were growing helter-skelter high up on the rusted structure. 100 yards away stood a concrete buttress dam. These days, when he wasn't in Haiti, he gave a lot of speeches, sometimes several in one day. And in every one I heard, he talked about the dam. It appeared in all the books he had published by 2000, and in the books that he had helped to write and edit, and also in many of his journal articles, 42 of those by then. As a scholar and writer, Farmer had taken his greatest pains to assert the interconnectedness of the rich and poor parts of the world, and the dam was his favorite case study. It stops up Haiti's largest river, the Artibonite. It's called the Peligre Dam, and the impounded waters behind it, the Lac de Peligre. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had planned it. Brown and Root of Texas, among others, built the structure in the mid-1950s during the reign of one of Haiti's American-supported dictators with money from the U.S. Export-Import Bank. It was advertised as a development project, and no doubt some of the people behind its creation believed it a gift to Haiti. But no one seems to have given much thought to the peasant farmers who lived in the valley upstream. The project was intended to improve irrigation and to generate power. It wasn't as though the peasants of the Central Plateau didn't need and want modern technology, Farmer said. But as they themselves often remarked, they didn't even get electricity or water for their land. Most didn't get money either. In fact, the dam was meant to benefit agribusinesses downstream, mostly American-owned back then, and also to supply electricity to Port-au-Prince, especially to the homes of the numerically tiny, wealthy Haitian elite, and to foreign-owned assembly plants. Since the flooding of the valley, many peasant girls and boys from Cange, children of what Farmer called the water refugees, had left home looking for work in the capital, where they cooked and cleaned and stitched Mickey Mouse dolls and baseballs, more than a few of them nowadays returning home with AIDS. When Farmer first saw this piece of Haiti and began to ferret out its history, old-timers talked longingly to him about the days before the water rose, when families lived on farms beside the river and everyone had enough to eat and something left over to sell. Some remembered being warned that their land was going to be submerged, but the river had always flowed by, and they'd examined the dam in progress, and they couldn't believe that a mere wall of concrete could hold back their river. One of the old people of Cange remembered seeing the water rising and suddenly realizing that his house and goats would be underwater in a matter of hours. "So I picked up a child and a goat and started up the hillside." Families had hurried away, carrying whatever they could save of their former lives, turning back now and then to watch the water drown their gardens and rise up the trunks of their mango trees. For most, there was nothing to do but settle in the steep surrounding hills, where farming meant erosion and widespread malnutrition, tending nearer every year toward famine. And for years, there were wailings and curses and loud arguments among old neighbors, fighting over titles to the land that was left. Things got worse. Even after the dam, most peasants still had their black, low-slung Creole pigs, which they kept like bank accounts, to pay for things such as school tuition. But in the early 1980s, they lost those as well. Alarmed about an outbreak of African swine fever in the Dominican Republic, afraid that it might threaten the American pork industry, the United States led an effort to destroy all the Creole pigs in Haiti. The plan was to replace them with pigs purchased from Iowa farmers, but these were much more delicate, much more expensive to house and feed, and they didn't thrive. Many peasants ended up with no pigs at all. When school started the year after the slaughter, enrollments had declined dramatically throughout the country and around Cange. We walked across the top of the dam. The railings were rusted, the concrete flaking. To our right, the roiled waters of the Artibonite rushed away, and to our left, a few small canoe-like vessels plied blue, placid waters. It looked almost like a tropical resort. Farmer walked briskly along. A small juvenile escort followed him for a time. local people heading the other way smiled when they saw him and said, "Bonjour, Doc Moin." Good morning, my doc. There were clouds, then sun, then clouds again, and a gentle breeze. I felt vigorous and cheered by borrowed popularity. On the other side of the dam, a footpath, loose dirt and stones, went straight up. Farmer had a slipped disc from 18 years of traveling Highway 3. His left leg had been surgically repaired after he'd been hit by a car back in 1988, and it turned out at a slight angle, like a kickstand, one of his brothers said. He had congenital high blood pressure and mild asthma, which developed after he'd recovered from a possible case of tuberculosis. But when I got to the top of that first hill, sweating and panting, he was sitting on a rock, writing a letter to an old friend, a contributor to Partners in Health, whose spouse had recently died. It was the first of many hills. We passed smiling children climbing steep, rocky paths that I had to clamber up on all fours. They were carrying water in pails and plastic jugs that once held things like paint, oil, and antifreeze. The full containers must have weighed half as much as the children did, and the children had no shoes. We passed beside many patches of millet, the national staple, which seemed to be growing out of rocks, not soil, and small stands of banana trees and, now and then, other tropical species. Farmer pausing to apply the Latin and familiar names, pawpaw, soursop, mango, a gloomy litany because there were so many fewer of each variety than there should have been. On a fair number of the trees that remained in those hills, and also on rocks, I saw political graffiti, usually scrawled in red paint, Titid, and the number 2001. These were, respectively, the nickname of former President Aristide, and the year in which, judging from all the posters and graffiti I had seen around Cange, he would be reelected. Politics, I supposed, was one means by which Haitian peasants avoided hopelessness. Many aid experts from prosperous places gladly expressed hopelessness on the Haitians' behalf, Farmer would say. By this point on our hike, I too was guilty. The houses we passed in the mountains were much worse than most of the ones around Cange. They had dirt floors and roofs made of banana fronds, which, Farmer pointed out, leaked during the rainy season, turning the floors to mud. We passed a group of women who were washing clothes in the rivulet of a gully. "It's Saturday," said Farmer. "Washing day. I guess the Maytag repairman didn't come." Haitians, he said, are a fastidious people. "I know. I've been in all their nooks and crannies. But they blow their noses into dresses because they don't have tissues, wipe their asses with leaves, and have to apologize to their children for not having enough to eat." "Misery," I said. But this would not suffice. He was on a roll. "And don't think they don't know it," he said. "There's a WL line, the 'they're poor but they're happy' line. They do have nice smiles and good senses of humor. But that's entirely different." Like many of his remarks, this one gave me pause. Just when you thought you had the hang of his world view, he'd surprise you. He had problems with groups that on the surface would have seemed like allies, that often were allies, in fact, with, for example, what he called WLs, white liberals, some of whose most influential spokespeople were black and prosperous. "I love WLs. Love 'em to death. They're on our side," he had told me some days ago, defining the term. "But WLs think all the world's problems can be fixed without any cost to themselves. We don't believe that. There's a lot to be said for sacrifice, remorse, even pity. It's what separates us from roaches." We walked on. I noticed, as I had around Cange, that many people we passed wore clothes from America, brand-name running shoes that had seen much better days, and baseball caps and T-shirts bearing the logos of professional sports teams and country clubs. Kennedy's was the generic name for stuff like that. Back in the 1960s, Farmer had explained, President Kennedy sponsored a program that sent machine oil, among other things, to Haiti. The Haitians tried to use the oil for other purposes, such as cooking, and concluded that the gift was of inferior quality. Ever since, the president's name had been synonymous here with second-hand and shoddy goods. Now and then, one saw another kind of import, meant strictly for adornment. There was a young worker at Zomi La Santé who wore a new-looking Haitian-style straw hat, on which he or his wife had sewn a homemade piece of cloth that read, Nike. We went on, deeper and deeper into the mountains, Farmer leading the way. We chatted front to back. I was drenched in sweat. I couldn't see even signs of perspiration on his neck, his pencil neck, as friends of his called it. Many people waved to him, the lifted hand motionless, the fingers fluctuant, like the legs of insects on their backs. Do you see how Haitians wave? Don't you love it? You dig? He said to me, waving back with his fingers. The trail wound across barren, steeply folded mountainsides. I had thought that I was fairly fit, but at the top of every hill, Farmer would be waiting for me, smiling and making excuses for me when I apologized. I was 14 years older. I wasn't used to the climate. The one-way trip to Morne Michelle usually took him 2 hours. About 3 hours after we'd set out, we arrived at the hut of the non-compliant patient, another shack made of rough-sawn palm wood with a roof of banana fronds and a cooking fire of the kind Haitians call three rocks. Farmer asked the patient, a young man, if he disliked his TB medicines.
Are you kidding? He replied. I wouldn't be here without them.
It turned out that he'd been given confusing instructions the last time he was in Cange, and he hadn't received the standard cash stipend. He hadn't missed any doses of his TB drugs, however. Good news for Farmer. Mission accomplished. He'd made sure that the patient's cure wasn't being interrupted. We started back. I slipped and slid down the paths behind Farmer. Some people would argue this wasn't worth a 5-hour walk, he said over his shoulder. But you can never invest too much in making sure this stuff works. Sure, I said, but some people would ask, how can you expect others to replicate what you're doing here? What would be your answer to that? He turned back and, smiling sweetly, said, fuck you. Then, in a stentorian voice, he corrected himself. No, I would say, the objective is to inculcate in the doctors and nurses the spirit to dedicate themselves to the patients, and especially to having an outcome-oriented view of TB. He was grinning, his face alight. He looked very young just then. In other words, fuck you. We started on again, Farmer saying over his shoulder, and if it takes 5-hour treks or giving patients milk or nail clippers or raisins, radios, watches, then do it. We can spend $68,000 per TB patient in New York City, but if you start giving watches or radios to patients here, suddenly the international health community jumps on you for creating non-sustainable projects. If a patient says, I really need a Bible or nail clippers, well, for God's sake. I was scrambling down yet another steep incline when from a copse below I heard a commotion, yelling, then a little lull, then yells again. In a few minutes, a cockfighting pit came into view, a corral entirely surrounded, several people deep, by men in straw hats and ragged pants and shirts, shod in torn sneakers, flip-flops, old brown dress shoes without laces. On the periphery, there were a pair of competing food sellers and a couple of men who had set up games of Zo. It involved a board and a thing that looked like a Victorian teapot for shaking dice. There were also women at the edges of the crowd. A place was made for Farmer at the railing. He watched for a moment. The cocks were circling each other. Then one made a charge, wings flapping, and Farmer turned away. He moved to the edge of the trees, where suddenly a couple of chairs materialized, metal chairs with torn naugahyde seats, one red, one blue. This always happened in the countryside when I was with Farmer, the appearance of chairs, one for Dr. Paul, one for his blanc. We sat. In a moment we were surrounded by women, a dozen or more, elderly-looking women, lovely young women in sundresses with one torn shoulder strap, a middle-aged woman with a beautiful face but several front teeth missing, leaned against a tree and spoke softly to Farmer. The others stood by other trees or sat in the dirt close by, some speaking to him too from time to time. One woman was telling him that they needed an additional community health worker up here, but mostly they were just passing the time. Is there a more widespread notion than the one that rural people are laconic? And is there a rural place anywhere in the world whose people really are? This book is continued on cassette 2.